Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Chris Dalta. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Work on land issues that includes our cleanup programs.
That's $10 fine.
And I'm Barb Narramore, assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I have our ecological and water resources, forestry, and lands and minerals divisions.
Thank you. Proceed.
Chair and committees, we're here today to talk a little bit about the 3M Natural Resources Damage Settlement that you've heard about in the news. And I just want to start off, this settlement allows for us to fundamentally change how we approach PFCs in the East Metro area and how we address and provide clean drinking water. Until now, we've had to work on a Band-Aid approach. We would do sampling, get well advisories, respond to the well advisories by providing clean drinking water, and we would go from well advisory to well advisory with standard changes in between that would require us to respond in different manners. What this fund and the Natural Resources Damages lawsuit allows us to do is really look at this at a holistic approach for the East Metropolitan area and how do we provide clean and reliable drinking water to residents and businesses. Just to understand a little bit of where we're today, we need to talk about a very brief history of PFCs in the East Metropolitan area. And to start off, I'd like to just define a couple terms. We're going to talk about PFCs, and they're a chemical developed and produced by 3M since the 1940s. They're in chemical and products such as StarchGuard and Teflon. And the thing about PFCs is they're very persistent in the environment. They don't break down. And there's also increasing research about their potential risks to animals, fish, and most importantly, humans. The other term we'll be using quite a bit here, and I've already used, is the East Metropolitan area. And I just want to kind of give you a sense of where that's at. On the fact sheet, you see a little map. But think of the communities on the north of Oakdale, Lake Elmo, Lakeland Township, Lakeland, Afton, and then moving south to Woodbury, Cottage Grove, Newport, St. Paul Park, and the township of Great Cloud Island. This is the area in general when we refer to the East Metro area that we're talking about and having concerns with PFCs. We started working on this as a state in 2002 when 3M informed MPCA about the presence of PFCs in their production wells in Cottage Grove. Between then and the next 5 years, through the oversight of MPCA, 3M did a number of investigations and sampling and started addressing some wells that were over drinking water limits, including the city of Oakdale and private residents. In 2007, the MPCA and 3M really formalized those responsibilities in a consent order. And you will hear us refer to the 2007 consent order a number of times today, and that's where this comes from. And it really outlines how we are going to, 3M's responsibilities to provide safe drinking water to affected residents, clean up the disposal sites, and also monitoring the groundwater. Another key date in this history is 2010, and that's where the Attorney General files the Natural Resources Damages lawsuit on behalf of the state and the trustees, MPCA, and the DNR. And this is the settlement we've talked about. All along this time, we've been working with the Department of Health in a partnership to provide clean drinking water to residents for these communities for over a decade. And just to talk a little bit about what we've been doing in the recent times, by 2016, the MPCA and the Department of Health had installed over 100 carbon treatment systems at private residents. At that time, we leveled off and were monitoring about 200 private wells to keep an eye on them for PFCs. And prior to that, a lot of work was done. Over 1,000 wells were sampled to get us to that point. But we were kind of at a status quo. Then a change happened in 2016 and 2017 with EPA and the Department of Health lowering drinking water health values. And that really kicked the agencies, Department of Health, and MPCA into overdrive. And we've sampled over 1,200 residential wells. We've had nearly 600 wells tested over the Department of Health's drinking water values. every one of these cases where it's over the values, as soon as the homeowner gets that notice from the Department of Health, the MPCA sends a letter providing bottled water to them through one of our contractors and asking if they would like to sign an access agreement to allow the state to come in and install a carbon treatment system. We'll often refer to it as a granular activated carbon system, or GAC, just in case I slip into the acronyms. I'll try not to. And so far, a lot of homes have done this. They've signed up. We have 470 have agreed to have these systems installed and already have 385 installed, and we're continuing to do sampling, installation of these systems as we move on. So the settlement isn't just the first opportunity we have to provide drinking water. This has been work that we've been doing, Department of Health and MPCA, over a decade, being reimbursed through 3M. And so this really drives us to what our natural resource damage is. We talked about how under Superfund we've moved from drinking water, well sampling, to advisories, and we're responding. Natural resources is really about that larger impact that's done to our groundwater, our aquatic resources, fisheries, our wildlife, and we're really looking at a long-term approach to how we handle this. All this work I've talked about is within the framework created by the legislature. The tools we have, Superfund, and the natural resources damages abilities, all outlined in 115B.04. And this is important because as we were having discussions about the lawsuit and also the settlement, we kept in mind that framework, the oversight that the legislature had created for the agencies in this way, and made sure we constructed the settlement in a way that matched what the legislature had outlined. So just if you read the settlement, there's a few major components here. One is there will be an $850 million grant to the state by 3M. Of that, $720 million is immediately available for long-term solutions for the East Metropolitan area in clean and reliable drinking water and restoration and enhancement of our natural resources. The grant also outlines some restrictions on how these dollars can be used and also sends a strong expectation of community participation, which the agencies have already started. And then finally, preserves 3M's obligations under the 2007 consent order. For instance, the three disposal sites that 3M is currently taking care of, the pump and treat and activities there, continue under that agreement and not under the settlement agreement. Those dollars do not go to it. So we talked about some of those priorities. Priority number one is clean drinking water to meet the current and future needs of these communities. And that second point just, again, highlights those communities we're talking to, but it's not limited to those. We're also looking at those if the plume moves or we find that the concentrations are at levels in other locations because of the 3M disposal sites. We can use those dollars, these dollars, for those activities also. So the underlying natural resources damages, we talked about putting treatment systems on wells that we've seen over limits. But there's also more damage to the local communities. A number of them are looking to grow and drop new wells into the aquifer, and they've had challenges because of the contamination there. And so those are some of the larger long-term things that we're looking to handle. So we want to look at alternative drinking water sources, whether that's different wells for groundwater, the river, treatment systems, municipal systems, where we have a density of homes, how do we hook those up to municipal systems instead of individual treatment systems for the long term? Another major component here is repairing the underlying aquifer. And that will also involve water conservation projects in the area and also preserving open spaces and recharging drinking water area sources. Our second priority is enhancing natural resources. As I mentioned earlier, a number of damages were done to the underlying aquifer, to the fisheries, and our aquatic resources. And this is where we will need to spend some time to restore and enhance natural resources in the East Metro area, and also those that are potentially impacted downstream of the Mississippi and St. Croix rivers. And so we're looking to restore and protect fish and wildlife habitat, restore access to outdoor recreation. And since we have this these two priorities, there isn't a line saying X dollars for one and Y dollars for the other. It will be determined on as we look at projects and the needs of the communities. But because this was a natural resources damages lawsuit, we wanted to make sure that up to $20 million was available to start on those natural resources projects that will be going on at the same time that we're working on the clean water projects and drinking water projects. There are some other expenses. We talked about earlier the $850 million grant and then how $720 million are available for those two priority areas. And these are the other expenses. One is the $125 million from the settlement will go to the outside counsel for the legal fees, their experts, the research and everything that was done there. The agencies will be reimbursed for about $300,000 for assessments and contract work we had to do on this. And then under the consent order from 2017, over the last few years, a number of local communities like Cottage Grove and MPCA and Department of Health have been working on sampling and working on systems for public and private wells. And so what this does is settles up that invoice so that will be going out to 3M for 2007 for those costs that they're required to cover under the 2007 consent order. So I talked earlier about that framework the legislature has set out for how natural resources damages lawsuit is carried out. And then also statute requires the grant that we receive from 3M and any natural resources damages to be deposited into the remediation fund. The funds are statutorily appropriated to the two state trustees, MPCA and DNR, from the remediation fund. And those are set out by statutes, 116.155, and 115B.20 are really the foundation the legislature has created this framework to work on. We've also already started working in SWIFT to create distinct accounting measures to make sure the money is dedicated and protected, and for legislative staff and others that use the SWIFT system to clearly see the pathway. They see the $850 million come in and start to see how it's used and appropriated in various functions, to allow for the transparency for the legislature to have their oversight role and provide the information that they need. The other piece that the financial framework is governed by is the agreement itself, which is overseen by the district court. And some of those are the needs to spend these dollars in the areas that are impacted, the East Metropolitan area. This is a longstanding philosophy of the legislature and previous administrations and our current agencies, that natural resource damage dollars go back to the areas where the damages have occurred. One of the other themes is working groups you'll see in the settlement. It talks about working group, but we anticipate there likely being multiple working groups because there's a lot of work to be done here in the two priority areas. And the MPCA and DNR is going to work collaboratively with the local communities and others to develop and prioritize the projects in the drinking water priority area and also the natural resources priority area. We have already reached out to our local units of government and had two conference calls to start this conversation, and we've been provided some good feedback from them on how do we create these working groups so it's not another layer of meetings, another organizations, and maybe use some of the structures that are already in place and really build on some of the plans that they've been working on for drinking water needs in the South Washington County area so we don't reinvent the wheel. And so in addition to those local communities being part of the working groups, we'll be including MetCounsel and the Minnesota Department of Health because of their role in these areas, and also 3M. And we'll pull in different experts as needed depending on the topics that the groups are working on. We've set a goal for ourselves to have this working group structure set up by the end of this month. And we will continue to seek input not only from the local units of government, from the residents of these communities themselves. And then the agreement also notes that the final decisions are made by MPCA and DNR. But I think it's very important to note that we really want to build this together in a collaborative slate of projects. And that's how we're looking to do this. Our intent is not to throw out an RFP, a request for proposal, and then have communities compete against each other for grants for their specific projects. This grant from 3M sets us up to really look holistically at the drinking water needs of these communities that have been adversely impacted because of the presence of PFCs. And we want to work together with the communities and build out that slate of projects. And so that includes public input, communications, reporting. We know this is very crucial, and we've been spending a majority of our time on this area right now. We have a website already up and running as of yesterday. We've delivered an email list for folks to track the progress. We will be doing periodic emails describing the activities we've been done. And this is open from legislators, the local communities, to citizens. We're looking for open houses and listening sessions this spring to reach to the individual citizens and answer their questions. We're looking to build out reporting systems so that we can have regular reporting to the legislature and to others that are interested, and not only describe what we've been doing and our progress, but also more detail of the financial transactions so they see where the dollars are going for various projects and the like. And then finally, I know our legislative directors from DNR and PCA have already set up every other week meetings with the local legislators in these communities to keep them briefed. So that will mirror the conference calls that we're having with the local communities, so everyone has an opportunity to provide input, ask questions, and get an update on what's going on. With that, I'd like to end our presentation and entertain questions.
Thank you. Representative Hugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Commissioner. I'm a little confused here now. Did the state win this lawsuit? It was a $5 billion lawsuit. But we did not win it, correct? There was a settlement?
Mr. Kudelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ugel, that is correct. This was a settlement of the case. There was no trial. There was no verdict.
Representative Ugel,
Mr. Chairman. So, in fact, it really didn't even go to trial. It was settled beforehand.
Ms. Nairmore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ugel, that is correct. It did not go to trial.
Okay.
Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I think the end result is pretty good here, because obviously the state's getting a bunch of money to remediate some of these issues, and clean water is something that we all enjoy. But now I have a question. What role did the Department of Health's report, which I believe stated that there was no problems with the drinking water in terms of increased cancer, reduced birth weights of children and things like that, what role did the Department of Health's report have in the settlement of the case?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ugel, in the decision to settle the case, obviously, the Attorney General's office and the two agencies were weighing a wide range of factors. I do think it is notable that we were in very serious settlement discussions prior to the release of the Department of Health's report. I'm not really in a position to characterize how the Health Department's report does or doesn't relate to the other expert reports that were prepared as part of trial preparation.
Mr. Chairman,
so the Department of Health found in their report that, again, that there was no increased cancer risk, no risk to babies and things like that. Now, how does that play into the remediation efforts that you're talking about right now?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there's a very nice info sheet that Department of Health puts out on PFCs, and it is very clear that there is increasing links in risk from PFCs to animals and humans. And that is what drives the Department of Health health-based values, HBVs, and health risk limits that they set in a conservative manner to make sure that we protect the drinking water and those who utilize it. Those numbers, those values, are what drive our remediation efforts. Those are what we see, exceedance of those in a well. That's when treatment moves forward with. So the Department of Health's data, their health-based values, and all that lead directly into the work we do at the MPCA and others areas.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum.
Commissioner, but in fact, 3M disputed your conclusions about the chlorinated solvents and things like that. And also, I believe they were disputing the levels that you've talked about where the, in fact, could you tell me, previously the drinking water standards were at so many parts per whatever it was, and they are now, could you give me those levels in terms of the changes that happened and how that came about?
Commissioner Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just to start off, the agencies collectively, Department of Health, MPCA, DNR, AG's office, we respectfully disagree with 3M on the impacts and the potential health risks of PFCs. The second question about standards, this is from a national growing body of work, and prior to 2016, the Department of Health had a health risk limit set for two of the PFCs at 300 parts per trillion. In 2016, EPA on a national level sent out drinking water guidance for those two chemicals and lowered that to 70 parts per trillion based on other information. The state of Minnesota and other states, New Jersey and others, have gone farther because of research, always advancing research, increased knowledge, and making sure we are protective for all types of humans. Even those most at risk. And in May of 2017, the Department of Health lowered for those two chemicals for PFOS to 27 parts per trillion and 35 parts per trillion for PFOA. Now, it's important to know this is based on the research on a national level. Other states, such as New Jersey and others, have already gone to the same area on their health-based values. Along with other states. EPA and states are working together and have created working groups to continue to work on PFCs because of the concern with the research and the concern of states, local communities, and residents in all of these communities that are being impacted by the chemicals.
Representative Ugel. Chair, thank you. Commissioner, what's a trillion?
Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm not a mathematician, so I can't give you that definition. It's a small amount, but just because it's small doesn't mean it has doesn't have an impact. What is the concern is whatever amount it takes to create that inverse impact in wildlife, fish, or most importantly humans is enough. And that's what we're concerned about is where does it create that adverse impact in all of us and the natural resources? And the studies, the Department of Health, national studies, and others have done have shown that even small amounts of these chemicals has the potential for those impacts. And right now I'm at the limit of my knowledge on this. Department of Health really are the experts on their values and can explain in more detail the formulas and the process they use on this. But I think it's important to remember that just because it's a small number doesn't mean it can't have a big impact.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Commissioner, a trillion is 1,000 billion, okay? And that's not a small amount. That's an infinitesimal amount. And I'm just arguing the fact here that these limits are getting to the point where, and 3M argued this in their case too, that you could have background incidences of contamination. And then you can also have sampling error. And in my prior life, I set up a lot of labs and analytical testing equipment and everything else in the paint and coatings manufacturing. And I just happened to run into one of my old suppliers the other day, he informed me that when you're sampling at those low limits, first of all, the technology is relatively new. And as you can imagine, we used to sample for parts per million. And in fact, OSHA, in their safety data sheets for these chemicals, is at parts per million in terms of their exposures. And I have those sheets in my office. So when you're sampling at this level out in the field and everything else, there's ample room for error. Parts per trillion and only 27 parts per trillion. You actually could take a typical beach up on Leech Lake and look at all the grains of sand on that beach, and you still wouldn't get down to 27 parts per trillion. So I'm just saying that we're really, really, and 3M is disputing this too, we're really, really getting down to the point where there are so many questions at these low levels, both in the sampling, both in the background contamination that can occur, and everything else, that we are doing more than splitting hairs. 1,000 billion. So, you know, I'm happy that we're getting the money. I just don't like the idea that 3M is being vilified. They settled for this, and they're being a good neighbor to the state of Minnesota. I used to sell 3M product, and 3M hasn't built a new plant in Minnesota for many, many years. Part of it is because of things like this, a $5 billion lawsuit. And there's a lot of jobs at stake, too, good jobs and good people. And they have good scientists. In fact, they have probably some of the best scientists in the world. And I put them up against anybody. So I just think that in the future, we have to take a look at some of these limits, which are set by your agency and peer review and other states, and consider whether they're realistic or not. Because at 27 parts per trillion, it's incredible to me. So thank you.
Thank you. I have a question real quickly. Commissioner Naramore, you said that, and I want clarification. I thought what I heard you say is that leading up to the time of settlement that there were negotiations going on in the background or whatever. And what I'm curious about is did you have the information that the Department of Health released to the public before they released it to the public? I want to know about that.
Mr. Chair, speaking for DNR only, we, I believe, had general information that the Department of Health was going to be releasing an updated report. I don't know that we had the report in our possession before its public release.
Did you have the content of the report, roughly? I mean, did you know verbally that the report was going to show that what it showed about birth weights and cancer rates and so forth?
Mr. Chair, committee members?
Sure.
The MPCA and Department of Health have a relationship that works on the health-based values and the information. We did not receive the report until it was released to the public. We did not see a copy. We had discussions with them and knew that they were looking into the issue and reexamining their data to look at and compare to studies that were done by the AG's consultants. However, we did not have the actual report until the day it was released to the rest of the public.
But my question is did you understand that the findings that they were going to be bringing forward were going to show that the rates of cancer and those things were not increased?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the discussions that they had with us started out with describing what they noted in terms of the work that was done with the consultant, the AG's hired, Dr. Sun Chi. And then they went up forward and started working on their own pieces. They had said that they were doing their own research and looking at the numbers, and that historically their previous looks at it had not shown a difference, which were all public reports that were out on their websites, and that they suspected that it would be similar to the previously published reports.
I'm still not clear on the answer, yes or no. Did you know the general content of the information that they were going to be releasing, yes or no?
Mr. Chair and committee members, their release of their most recent report, I know the Department of Health can talk about this in more detail. They have a hearing and with the Health and Human Services Committee at 1 o'clock, but they had reaffirmed that it supported what was already publicly released in their previous reports, and that is what they told us. Information that was already public released, that their data showed the, when they were doing it, what they suspected it would show the same thing.
Commissioner Kadelka, to be clear, did you or did you not know about the content of the report in one fashion or another before it was released?
Mr. Chair and committee members, a couple days before, they had said that they were still wrapping up the report, and it said that their information was showing that it was following their previously public release reports.
Which means what?
The data that they had, again, Department of Health is the best to outline what's in those reports. I've not spent time on that, that our work has more dealt with the remediation and the cleanup of the activities.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. PCA was testing fish in this area early on, probably about 2002, and finding that there were more PFCs in the fish than any other place in the world. What is your current testing of fish showing?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I will need to get back to you. I'm not up to speed on the latest of what the results are for sampling the fish. It is something we're continuing to look at, especially with the changing values in 2017 from the Department of Health.
If I could follow up.
Gorgenius.
Well, then let me ask a question a different way, or approaching this question in a different way. In your presentation on page four, you said that you're going to restore and protect fish and wildlife habitat, and you testified that you were going to repair the aquifer. What do you think that is going to cost to do the restore and protect fish and wildlife habitat and repair the aquifer? What do you think that's going to cost?
Commissioner Kadelka. Oh, excuse me, Ms. Nearmore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, we do not have an all-in cost estimate number for that work. We know that there are significant and important projects that can be done, but I don't have a total dollar value.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, do you have an estimate or a range?
Ms. Nearmore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, we could certainly spend over $100 million on the non-drinking water-related natural resource damages.
Representative Wagenius.
And if you did that, would you have restored and protected fish so that they were edible and repaired the aquifer? Would we get that outcome that you're...
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, we would certainly have made substantial restoration and enhancement gains. Would we have eliminated the natural resource damages in their entirety? In all likelihood, not.
Representative Wagenius.
There's a big gap between making progress and having a habitat, but here you say restore and protect. So this is the testimony to us. And what I'm trying to get at is if you don't know what the fish are testing now, and you don't have a number that you can give us to do what you are telling us you're going to do, then I'm having trouble understanding why you settled on this amount without knowing the outcomes that you could get for the citizens.
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, there are a number of factors that go into an agency or the Attorney General's decision to settle a court matter. And we certainly look at the sufficiency of the funds being offered in settlement to address the natural resource damages. We don't have the information available to us to determine whether we will, with those funds, be able to entirely eliminate the natural resource damages associated with the PFC contamination. That is simply the reality that we face.
Yep. Representative Wagenius.
This lawsuit has been in process for many, many years.
Speak into the microphone, please.
Thanks. This lawsuit's been in process for many years, and it seems to me that we needed to know how much it was going to cost to remedy the damage to the natural resources. And what I'm hearing is that you all had not made that estimate, and we don't have specific plans, and that's very troubling.
Thank you. Representative Kornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that a number of residents are needing to use bottled water and have for a number of years. Is that going to continue? What's the number of residents, and what's the cost of providing them the bottled water?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, everyone has received a drinking water well advisory from the Department of Health, has been offered bottled water from the state. In addition, if it is a private home, we have been working with them to put in a carbon treatment system, a GAC. Some have decided not to take us up on that offer. That is their choice. We cannot force them to. And so we make these offers to them. So everyone has the ability to have bottled water in a treatment system. In the case of municipalities, we don't have any municipalities on bottled water. We have a temporary carbon treatment system in Cottage Grove. Cottage Grove built the structures for them at two well locations, and the MPCA is helping with the cost of renting those pieces of equipment and the carbon changeout. So if residents who have received a drinking water advisory from the Department of Health, if they have not been contacted by a contractor, please feel free to have them contact us, and we'll make sure that we talk to them again about getting an access agreement to get in and get a drinking water system installed in their homes.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kadelka, when you say temporary, what are the parameters around what's the time frame of the temporary carbon system that you described?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we'll start with the city of Cottage Grove as a temporary system. We know that it has a number of years that it can work in this way, but we need a long-term solution for the city of Cottage Grove, whether it's a permanent drinking water treatment system or alternative sources of water. In terms of private individual homes, those communities or neighborhoods that have a density where it may make sense with the grant dollars to run water lines out to and hook them all up to municipal drinking water systems, a carbon treatment system in their home would be temporary at that point. A carbon system in a private home that is 5 miles from a municipal water line and others, the permanent solution then is an in-home carbon treatment system because the cost effectiveness of running a water line out to one home doesn't work out compared to what we need to do to provide resources to all the homes.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, next, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not sure which one of you will be the best one to answer this, but I was a little disappointed that we didn't have a copy of the actual settlement here in our packet, because as we know, the devil's really in the details. And I was able to pull it up online and start to take a look at it. Just want to clarify for everyone else on the committee and the public, it looks like the funds, you would have to reasonably have reached the goal of addressing the drinking water needs before you could use any funds for any of the other wildlife natural resources needs. Is that correct?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is not entirely correct. So of the $720 million that's available for projects, the vast majority will first be reserved to ensure that we reasonably achieve the priority one, drinking water and groundwater sustainability goals, but up to $20 million, so less than 3%, but up to $20 million of that $720 million is immediately available for the priority two other natural resource damage work.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, and I think that wasn't exactly my reading of it, and I think that just brings home how the way these things are drafted is incredibly important, as we've seen when other times when there are large pots of money that suddenly become available, people start to play games with where that money goes. And I'm concerned in the way that the settlement is drafted. There's a lot of, which may include but is not limited to, type language. And that concerns me as far as making sure that this money is actually going to exactly the damages that were created by 3M. So if could you speak a little bit about how you're going to oversee that and make sure that this money is spent the way that the intent, I think, really is, even if that intent is not as clear as it could be in the settlement?
And just real quickly, our pages are making a copy of the settlement, so you'll get those, okay? To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are a number of steps that we will be taking to ensure that the expenditures are consistent with the terms of the settlement. On a personal aside, I will say in the drafting of the settlement agreement, obviously many people are working on that document, reviewing it, offering their perspectives on what different language means. And so I can appreciate the fact that different people will read the same material differently. And we strove, as a fundamental principle in drafting, to ensure both clarity and a reasonable degree of flexibility, knowing that there are some unknowns associated with where the groundwater plume could potentially move, or what the full nature of some of these natural resource damages is. So that's part of the reason you see some of that language. But to your point or question about how we will ensure consistency, there are a number of steps that we'll be taking there, one of which is as the co-trustee agencies, we will be developing our own, and we don't know whether it will take the form of an MOA or an operating agreement or some type of written agreement between the two agencies that will guide our implementation work. We will be, as Assistant Commissioner Fidelka described earlier, establishing one or more work groups to ensure that we are collaborating fully with the affected communities, with some of our sister agencies that have roles to play here. I think that will be very important, and clearly one way that a wide range of people will be able to ensure consistency with the terms of the settlement agreement. Among the folks who will be certainly invited to participate will be 3M itself, and as the company providing the grant, they have a very strong and clear interest in ensuring implementation compatible with the terms of the settlement. We fully anticipate additional an ongoing, very close work with the legislature around ensuring the consistency with the settlement. And then the final piece I would point to is that ongoing jurisdiction that the court has retained under the terms of the settlement.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my final question, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about whether there's been any work in looking into the effects that this pollution may have on agriculture and small farms that might be in the area. We know water doesn't just stay in one place. It can affect the soil and other things. And so I also have some concerns about that. And, again, that would be even further down the list of priorities in the agreement. So I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit to that and whether you think that there's actually enough money here to deal with all of this.
Assistant Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the Department of Health has done some studies dealing with gardening and some types of agriculture and workers. That is not something the MPCA has done work on, and the Department of Health has taken the lead on that area.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is the Environment Committee, and I would encourage the MPCA as far as pollution control. That's going to also include the effects on our food and workplaces. It's a little frustrating to not be able to think a little bit bigger than just the, you know, measuring the numbers in the water here. I would ask, whether, either of you think this is enough money to actually fix the full scope of these problems.
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I heard the question as being what type of research has been done. And the research that's been done so far, the Department of Health has taken the lead on. Those impacts to the natural resources, the aquatic resources and things, as Assistant Commissioner Nairmore has mentioned, are things that we will be working on as we move forward. So I didn't mean to belittle that aspect of it. It's just the existing research is being led by the Department of Health. The second question on the terms of the dollars, these dollars will, as I mentioned early on, it's fundamentally going to change how we've been able to deal with PSCs in this area in terms of clean drinking water and also habitat restoration and aquatic resources that we have not been able to do to this date. And so the settlement really provides that opportunity for us in the local communities to do something we wouldn't have been able to do before. And that, well, personally, I'm happy with that ability to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Karen Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of questions. First of all, building on the last point that was just being made, does the natural resources definition here include soil? So you're talking about natural resources, groundwater, surface water, fisheries, wildlife, natural habitats. I assume natural habitats, I assume it could include soil, and I'm asking that for a specific reason. Does it or doesn't it?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I don't believe the statute rules it in or out what natural resource damages includes that.
I didn't understand your answer,
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the actual statute itself, I don't believe, mentions soil being in or out. So as part of we look at the holistic realm of natural resources, that'll be something that we look at it and its impacts to wildlife and humans and others.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, in other words, it could include soil. And part of the reason I ask that is because of the MPCA's involvement with the Washington County landfill. Over the years, the cleaning of some of the landfill involved, as I understand, a very high tube that went into the ground and brought the water, brought the liquid out of the landfill. Aerated it with the purpose of trying to break down some of those compounds that could be broke down by being aerated. But in the meantime, it also included things like the PFCs, which, of course, are not broken down by just being exposed to air. You know that they're extremely tight compounds. So my question is, or my concern is the question about understanding, like, some of the farmland around there by some of the Hmong farmers and others would have been exposed to some of that. And from what I've seen, I've been out there when that was running. It's no longer in operation, but when it was running, you could see that, you know, that was within a block of some of the most beautiful Hmong farmland gardens that I've seen, where that was being exposed. So one of the questions I have is, can you tell me a little bit about the leachate that was coming out of there and also going into the other sources, the groundwater and so on? What was being tested by MPCA or the health department, or, you know, tell me what was in that leachate that could have been distributed to the land, to the water?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I don't have that data with me. We can set up a time to go over that in some more detail. As you mentioned, the landfill at one point had an aeration system to break down VOCs as a treatment option, and that has ceased to go on. And so it is now a lined facility with leachate being controlled in a different manner, but leachate being the water that's created from the waste from that landfill.
Mr. Chairman, there's several leachates that should be pretty well known to MPCA and DNR. And do we have to have the health department come down and talk about this? I mean, I don't know if they're here, but I know the MPCA knows something about some of the leachates. Can you just tell us what you do know about, you know, like PFOS, PFOA? Can you just tell us which of those you know have been released from Washington County landfill in particular, but any of the three areas?
And just before I answer that question, is there someone here from MDH? Phone a friend. Proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we do have that information. I just don't have it with me here today on the exact characteristics of the sampling around the closed landfill that you're talking about, the Washington County closed landfill. So we can definitely make that available to the committee and have a further discussions on it. I just don't have it. Those specific numbers and the characteristics of the well sampling with me at this time.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering if there's anybody from MPCA can answer. This is a general question. This is not a really hard scientific question.
Raise your hand if you can answer the question.
Mr. Chair,
Assistant Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair, I'm seeing head shaking. No, we will need to get back on the specifics, sure. But there were, at the time of the landfill, there were VOCs and PFCs, the exact concentrations and that we would need to get back to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Clark.
Okay. We've had some of that discussion in previous, you know, discussions right in this committee, and I remember with our previous chair had a deep interest in this area, and we talked about it. It's a little disappointing not to be able to go forward since we started talking about cancer rates and so on. I mean, I just feel like we need this information. Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about current remediation research that's going on? What you know about that? Either of you, I guess, because I know that there has been University of Minnesota and others have been working on some remediation issues and techniques.
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there are national efforts to research PFCs, not only their impacts and the like, but also on ways that for treatment. Currently, we use carbon treatment systems to remove PFCs from drinking water when it comes up. In terms of research in other ways to remediate it in groundwater without pulling the groundwater up and sending it through carbon treatment system and sending it back down, I'm not aware of those studies. There may be. We would have to get back to you on it. We just don't have that information available right now. This is a fairly new chemical, and the treatment systems have been really focusing on once we have the water accessible to us and be able to clean it up in terms of coming out of a well or the such. Treating in place in the groundwater is not something that we have technology or using today.
So, Mr. Chairman,
okay, Clark.
So you're not aware of current research that's being done to provide that kind of remediation here in our own state?
Assistant Commissioner Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, right now 3M is doing pump and treat around its three disposal sites. It has removed PFCs from those sites and brought them to a lined facility. Those are the treatment things being done right now, additional research that's being done to go beyond those types of treatments and to treat the groundwater in place. Those are ongoing research pieces. I just do not have information on them today. We can look and see what we have, what's being done on a national level, and we can get back to you.
Mr. Chairman, Clark. So maybe this is a question for you. I mean, there's a lot of questions that I have that are not apparently being able to be answered today, and I think others may have them too. Are we going to have another chance to hear from MPCA and Department of Health and all these folks? Because this is this is not satisfactory. These are real basic questions that I'm asking, and I would really like to make sure that we're going to have a chance in this committee to look at these environmental impacts.
Sure. I guess my answer to that is I'd be happy to work with you to see if we can't schedule something else. Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
I have another question. So I know we're not retrying the settlement here, but my colleague who raised the issue about cancer incidents and about the health department report on that, I would just like to point out to the committee that there's a big concern with how our Minnesota Department of Health collects its cancer data. So I don't know if either of the folks here know, but can either of you tell me whether or not the Minnesota Department of Health collects the residential history of people who have cancer, who are diagnosed and reported to have cancer in our cancer registry in Minnesota? And so this is specifically referring to people who have lived in these areas, for example, to have a valid cancer registry and a valid report, we would have to know the residential history of people who are reported in the cancer registry. Do you, either of you know whether we collect that data in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Kadelka.
Chairing committee members, I do not. The Department of Health would be able to elaborate on that more. I know they're talking about their research later in the Health and Human Services Committee at 1 o'clock, and we can pass on that question to them and have them get back to the committee on that.
Does our other
Representative Clark.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Just want to ask.
All right.
Do you happen to know?
Ms. Naramore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I do not know.
Okay.
Representative Clark.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm going to be leaving here the end of this session, and the one thing I really wanted to have accomplished, which somebody else will probably have to pick up, is a very inadequate cancer registry that we have at the state of Minnesota. It does not collect residential history except for immediate residential history of where someone is living at the time of their cancer diagnosis. So it leaves out the kind of information that we would want people who live over in these East Metro communities to be able to have to answer the question of whether or not there is increased incidence of cancer there, because this has been going on for, what was it, 1950s, that we've had exposure for the folks there. So that's a long time. And those of us who have experienced cancer know that one of the things about it is the trigger for cancer can be set 40, 50 years ahead of time. You know, it doesn't happen just in a year or two or 10 or even 20 sometimes. So I just want to say that concern in that report from the Department of Health, I think, is very inadequate, and I would like us to look at that a little bit more. And somebody else, maybe you, Mr. Chairman, or other, will have to carry on this effort to make sure we get good scientific data for our cancer registry. I think the other thing I think maybe MPCA might know this. I don't know if this is a health department question too, but we do know that in some of the other states where 3M has shared their patent and there have been PFC products created, the workers, the scientists, the people who did the work in those laboratories do have reported increased incidences of certain health problems, including cancers, but including other things that relate to the kidneys and bladder and other sort of things like that. There's a lot of systemic damage done by human exposure to PFCs that I've learned about. I know Dow Chemical and others have, DuPont, excuse me, and others have looked at this. So I'm just wondering, can you tell us anything about that, or is this a way to another information from the Department of Health?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that research and that is done by the Department of Health, and those are the experts that we rely on to do our work, and so they would be the ones that I know they keep up with the most recent literature, whether it's research with wildlife, individuals drinking water with PFCs in, or workers. It's something that they keep apprised on, and it helps inform their health-based values and health risk limits.
Okay.
But we rely on their expertise.
So just the last thing I'm going to say about that, and then I'll pass it on to whoever else is the next person. The cancer registry also does not include occupational data. So there's no occupational history that is reported to the Minnesota Department of Health Cancer Registry based on an individual's occupational history. And one of the ways this became very important a number of years ago, those of you who follow what happened in the mining, in our northern Minnesota mining workers who were exposed to asbestos, I mean, it's one of the examples of, you know, occupational exposure that's clearly related to a particular type of cancer. It's not recorded. So we just, I guess when we look at these two areas of residential and occupational exposure, so the scientists at 3M and the other areas where this product is produced would not have that information put into a cancer registry. And so, again, our data is inadequate there. I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm hoping that we can, you know, follow up on this with another hearing where we can actually get some of these answers since the current witnesses do not know.
Well, Representative Clark, I would say that a lot of these questions are for the Department of Health, and I don't mind necessarily doing that here, but when they fall under the jurisdiction of Health and Human Services, maybe that's an alternative for you as well. Not saying we're not going to do it, but you understand where I'm going.
I do, Mr. Chairman. I don't serve on that committee. I don't serve on that committee. And I do know they have in the past testified about the 3M issues in this committee, so I'm just hoping we can bring them back.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to shift gears here just a little bit and talk, give members a little background information on the remediation fund. And I'd like to turn to our fiscal analyst, Mr. Hagemeyer, to give us some background and give us kind of your take on what's going on here, please.
Mr. Chair, it's complicated. Obviously, there's lots of cross-references in statute, how this will exactly work, and I don't have everything in front of me, but I can give you a little higher over level of what I think is happening. How
and maybe in the future you can get us more detail.
I can maybe provide more detail in the future, and maybe the agency can help how it's how they think it's flowing through here. In Chapter 116.155 is the creation of the remediation fund. And that's where the money is presumably going into, or we know it is going into. I think it's probably coming in the next week. I don't know if you've received the money yet or not, but I think it's supposed to be within 2 weeks, so probably in the next week they'll be receiving the money. Just in general, there's language in statute saying that any action based on a lawsuit or settlement has to go to the general fund unless it's on behalf of a person, entity, or fund. So I believe they're taking the grant as a settlement towards the fund on behalf of the fund, so they're able to put it in the remediation fund instead of the general fund. There is a natural resource damage account in the remediation fund currently that we have a little bit of money that gets appropriated out of there statutorily. That one isn't actually created in statute, that account. I don't know if that one was in section law or if they were able to do that on their own or not. There's language in Chapter 16A that allows the Commissioner of MMB to create accounts necessary for the basically processes of the state. I believe that's how they're creating a new account to manage this fund. So they're creating a clean water and sustainability account within the remediation fund. Basically, instead of just dumping this large amount of money into the natural resource damage account that's currently there, it's better to do it that way, to have a new account for it. So I believe they're using the authority in 16A to create a new account in the remediation fund. So in the remediation fund, the money in the general portion of the remediation fund is appropriated to the agencies and agency and the commissioners, ag and natural resources for the purposes they're using it. In the broader creation, it says, in addition to the general portion of the fund contains the two accounts described in section or subdivisions 4 and 5, and that's the dry cleaner account and the Melcat account. So this one wouldn't necessarily be a statutorily created account, but the agency is creating it under 16A to manage the purpose of the grant that they're receiving from 3M. And then I'm guessing because it says it contains the two accounts in 4 and 5, this one would fall in the general portion, which would allow them to use the statutory language that it's appropriated to them for the purposes of 115B.17 and 20. I don't know if that's 100% accurate or not, but I believe that's kind of how it flows into the state here. So it would be the $725 million is flowing under remediation funds, creating a new account in there for the purpose of this fund's specific share.
I think one of the tasks that we're charged with maybe or need to look at is the guardrails that are around that, you know, as we move forward. I have a couple of questions that I'd like to ask with regards to the remediation fund and making sure that the dollars get to where They need to go for natural resources. When I went to the update session after the settlement was announced, we met over in the Capitol, and one of the things that was talked about there, and this is kind of a small thing, but they talked about the possibility of creating a fishing pier. I really struggle with how does that have anything to do with restoration or enhancement of natural resources. Can you address? I'm concerned that these dollars actually go to clean things up and not to do other things. Ms. Nairmore.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, because we have heard that generating some concern and confusion. The notion, and let me preface this by saying, you know, we have not made any determinations that fishing piers or boat accesses would be a priority for expending funds, but the settlement agreement does identify a range of possible types of projects so that we have that flexibility and we have the understanding with the grantor about what the range might potentially entail. But to your question of what does that have to do with restoring or enhancing natural resources that were damaged, we know that there are many people in the East Metro who fish either recreationally or for subsistence. The purpose of a fishing pier under this natural resource damage settlement, if built, would be to provide those people with access to non-PFC contaminated fish.
Thank you. And then the other thing, it's not unusual. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Ms. If you're in a train of thought, you can finish.
I'm always in a train of thought.
but I had something on the earlier part, but I will, after Mr. Hagemeyer's comment, I have something.
Thank you. The other thing that I'm concerned about is that we frequently hear about agencies billing different entities and so forth for the work that they do. Is the Department of Health or MPCA or DNR going to be billing the remediation fund for services as they move forward?
Mr. Chair, we have not made any determinations about what resource needs we might have to implement the settlement agreement, but I am certainly able to say that the agencies are committed to minimizing any administrative costs associated with implementation. We are, however, simultaneously committed to ensuring that we are able to appropriately administer and implement the settlement agreement, and there may be some staff costs associated with that.
Okay. Thank you. That doesn't give me a lot of confidence, but that being said, Representative Hansen, to your point, and members, we have some people that have traveled here. I would like to wrap this up, and I give you my commitment that we will try to continue this discussion in this community at some point in the future. So, Representative Hansen, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and following up on Mr. Hagemeyer's point, I am very concerned to make sure that there are strong guardrails on these funds. We have recent history where funds get borrowed from with the promise to pay back, and then they don't get paid back, or they just get taken. And so, and I understand, you know, in the printed material we received that the concern about or having some assurance that this is a settlement, but if we look even last year with the VW, which I think is coming up, there were bills to
not today, I don't think,
to allocate that. So I think we need to have that conversation, because looking at how long this goes on, we have to have some protection of those funds that it provides for the drinking water. To Mr. Kadelka and Ms. Nairmore, I am disappointed that this did not go to trial. If this case had gone to trial, all of these discussions that we just had would have occurred in a courtroom, mm-hmm. and we would have had the public involved in what decisions were made by whom, when, and why?
And where.
And where. Both in the agencies, but also in the company. And we could have had testimony on what it meant for the citizens of Minnesota and for the constituents in these areas. And my district is right next to it, right across the river. So I understand the short-term desire to settle. And I understand the effort that was made here to get these dollars. But we could have had a discussion in a courtroom, and a decision could have been made, and we could have aired all of this out, and I guess that's why we have a settlement. To Representative Uglum, there are no naturally occurring PFCs. I just checked for reference, Genesis. God created heaven and earth. It doesn't say God created heaven and earth in PFCs. There are no background. Man created this. Man created this, and we have to live with it. And it is forever. We had testimony today that we don't know how long these will last. So $850 million is not infinity. It's not an infinite dollar. And at some point, probably after we're gone, maybe after our grandchildren are gone, this will have to continue to be addressed. Maybe there will be science to clean it up. We know, because of ongoing science, that very small amounts of chemicals can have very consequential actions, not just cancer, but in development and growth, endocrine disruptors, things that we didn't think of in the 50s or the 60s. So, Mr. Chair, I hope, following up on Representative Clark's, we have more questions. These questions could have been in a trial, and we could have had that discussion. And the state may have lost, or 3M may have lost. But that's the system that we're set up in. And the settlements that have occurred previously have been in other states have been years ago. We have more data now, and we could have had that battle of science in a courtroom, but we didn't. So now we have this in front of us, $850 million, and I want to make sure that we protect that for the people of Minnesota to have some drinking water and an environment if they're going to be fishing or if they're going to be growing crops, if they have some protection with the money we have and with the 2007 agreement.
Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who I'm directing this question at, but there was an $850 million settlement, and then after we pay the outside counsel and Cottage Grove, we have $720,500,000. That's a lot of money. I'm assuming that that goes into an account, a fund that at a minimum is interest bearing, and $720 million is going to throw off a lot of cash, or I hope it does, and I'd like to make sure that that stays within this fund. So I guess that's my question.
Mr. Hagmeyer.
Mr. Chair, I'm guessing that's slightly directed at me. I don't know if PCA has an answer to that yet since they don't have the money in hand yet. Accounts that have a balance in them do receive some interest. All the accounts in the state, a lot of that is just like an invested treasurer's cash rate, which is very small. We do specify accounts within PCA, even CLIF and MLCAT, the Closed Landfill Investment Fund, and the Metro Landfill Contingency Action Trust Account. We specify in the statute that they must be invested at the State Board of Investment so they get a higher rate of interest. They have different purposes. Those are long-term, you know, goals. I don't know how the spending will flow out of here, if it'll be, you know, a large chunk within the first year or two, or if some of it's going to lag 20 years. I don't know how long it'll last, so how it should be invested, I'm not entirely sure.
Representative Postman.
Thank you. Like Representative Hansen, I want to make sure that this money goes to where it belongs, and I would like to, you know, see that interest go to where it belongs.
And I expressed that myself, too, and I'm sure everybody else feels that. Representative Fisher, quickly, please.
Thank you. I'll just go to the one question I have that people in my community are asking the city of Maplewood. Is there's one of the dump sites was within a mile of the city of Maplewood, but I know St. Maplewood was not in the included in the area, and I know that some of these folks have got wells or down in the south leg, down in the Woodbury area. Was there a reason that they were not included in it?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the language itself says includes, but is not necessarily limited to. So if there are PFC issues dealing with the city of Maplewood, they would be a part of the piece. I would have to look at my email list server and see if we can add the city of Maplewood if they'd like to be part of those conversations. I do know there is at least one private well in the southern part of the city that does have a carbon treatment system. So we are monitoring and sampling in that area, and they have not been forgotten at all. And we'd be more than happy if they would like to provide input and be part of the conversation, especially on the local government calls that we have regularly.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you.
Okay. Just want to keep. Yep. Thank you. Representative Lagunas, quickly, please.
This is quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for having the settlement
that
I handed out.
That would be directed to Ms. Zipko, but yes, you're welcome.
I am looking at page 4 where it says that grants for projects that restore fishing. So, Mr. Kudelka, when you talked to us before that you did not have the data on the fishing, I think having the data originally, it was around 2002, I think, when so many PFAs were found in fish. If you could have a chart that shows us then and fishing, how much PFCs is fishing over the years to current, so we can see the trend line and see where we need to go. So that would be one thing if we could do that, Mr. Chair, and have that for not just me, but for the committee.
Sure.
And the other thing, Mr. Kudelka, you testified that you're taking out PFCs and putting them in a lined facility. Why not a hazardous waste facility?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the 3M disposal sites, 3M removed the materials and brought them to a lined facility. SKD. The Washington County landfill is a lined facility, and I believe the legislature set out some determinations on the lining system for that and helped with dollars to get that project taken care of. But we believe those are adequate ways for their disposal.
We did work on the Washington County landfill, but not as a hazardous waste. It's not a hazardous waste landfill. So my question is, why aren't you putting these in it? It is hazardous waste. Why aren't you putting in a hazardous waste landfill?
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I just know the history of what has been done. These are activities that have occurred years ago. I can go back and see what the conversations were at that time and need to get back to you.
At a minimum.
Thank you. Representative Clark, real quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a question to you. I asked a number of questions, and there was the answer that we'll find out later. I just want to make the commitment that I would put in writing my questions to them and then have that come back to all the committee members. It might save us some time.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, folks. We're going to move on here, not to diminish or minimize the topic that we have been discussing today, but we do need to move on to the freeway landfill. Would those folks please come down to the witness table? Mr. Kudelka and Ms. Naramore, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome back, and for those of you who have not yet, please identify yourselves for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greta Gothier, Legislative Director, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Today on Freeway Landfill, we wanted to give you just a quick overview of kind of the cleanup, what's happening, and the bonding. And then we can have a discussion about the report that the legislature required that we submitted on our progress on this landfill. So our bonding request, capital budget bonding request this year, has three programs in it. You can see that Freeway Landfill is the biggest of the three at $52.763 million. The total cost of this cleanup is $90 million. $90 million. And that includes the freeway landfill and the dump. In your packet, there's a little more about the closed landfill program. I'm not going to go into that in the interest of time. But if you turn to the fourth slide, you can see a little map. And I think it's always good to get oriented. So you see the Minnesota River crossing the top, and then that the I-35 is running right down the middle. So this landfill was built on a wetland just next to the Minnesota River before it connects to the Mississippi River. Last year, the legislature included in the cleanup the freeway dump. So total cost of the cleanup is $90 million. We got $3 million last year to start the work, and we very much appreciate that. So now we're down to $87 million. We have broken that into two further parts, so we're asking for $52.763 million this year. And in the interest of time, I won't go into the details and leave that for your perusal. But here's an estimated, I can't say that enough, it's estimated because we don't know what we're going to find when we get into these landfills, especially the dump. We anticipate after, if we get the bonding request this year, we'll need another $34 million or so, possibly more, depending on what we find and what the nature of the cleanup action required will be. So I just wanted to give a quick overview of that so that members have that brief update. And I think Assistant Commissioner Kadelka, I also put in a fact sheet on Freeway Landfill for your perusal. And Mr. Chairman also included this map of all the closed landfills in Minnesota. The state of Minnesota is responsible for maintaining and these landfills forever. So just so you can see, and in the little pull-out box at the bottom of the metro area, you can see Freeway right there at the bottom. The dots in green are the ones that the state of Minnesota owns. The ones that are a blue dot are not state-owned. Sometimes when people enter the closed landfill program, they decide to keep the property because they own a business on adjacent property or other reasons along those lines. So there's a very abbreviated version.
Thank you. Can you, either of you, let me know where are we at with regards to the EPA and the state and that transition that's going on there? Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for record again, Kirk Kadelka, Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. In January, we did submit to the legislature a report on the priority qualified facilities legislation that was enacted last year with the help of the legislature. It goes into more detail than I will right now on the topic, but specifically there were two parts going on. One, as the chair mentioned, ongoing discussions with the EPA and MPCA on moving this from a federal Superfund process to the closed landfill program process. And that is governed by a deferral agreement between the two parties. EPA is fine with the legislation, has stopped its work on the Superfund process as a result of it, and we're finalizing that deferral agreement. That deferral agreement overall has how we handle decisions on the cleanup of these landfills, and there has been this is an agreement that was put together a number of years ago, and we're actually doing some updates overall because of situations we've run into with other landfills, not Freeway Landfill, that we've been working on and just working that out. We anticipate that we should have this done very soon. We are in agreement and concept and just looking at the very finalized dates. When that is when that is done, EPA has stated they will send us the bill for the amount that they have so far incurred. The state will cover those costs instead of the named potential responsible parties you've heard from previously. And then they will officially send an official letter out to those potential responsible parties, letting them know officially EPA has sent this over to the state and they're no longer moving forward with their Superfund process at those sites, on those potential responsible parties.
Ms. Guthrie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly, the main reason that it's taken us a long time to get this agreement signed and sealed with EPA is due to some changes in staffing in the Chicago Regional Office. So that is taking part of the time. And also, once we get that agreement signed, then EP will, as Commissioner Kudelka said, will send out those letters to the folks who got the letters last year. We'll send them out a letter saying they are no longer a potential responsible party.
Okay, good. That was going to be another question of mine. And then the site investigation, where are we at there?
Sure. Mr. Chair and committee members, the legislation outlines a various steps that the agency has to do to provide due process to the landowner's rights. The first was a 60-day period to try to reach a binding agreement. That's the agreement between the landfill owner and the state on providing access and an interest in the property to be able to do the cleanup. Unfortunately, that did not come to a satisfactory conclusion. The owner was unwilling to sign the agreement. MPCA then approached him voluntarily for access to start the investigation that Director Gauthier has talked about. We were denied. We filed the court documents, set to go to trial to the courts on December 28th of last year. The day before, we were told they would sign. So we now have an access agreement to do phase one or phase A of the investigation. We've been out to the site once to do some markings and determine where we need to do some well and other monitoring and digging for our investigation. However, we were not able to complete our work and have trying to set up another date but have been unsuccessful reaching the landfill owner. Our intent is once that work is done, we within 2 weeks would be able to send out heavy equipment to do that phase A investigation.
So when you say you're unsuccessful in contacting them, give me some details. The owner.
We have not received a return phone call.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question's back on the bonding, and I'm looking at the letter from the city of Burnsville, and at the bottom of it references redevelopment and economic development. And maybe this is a question for staff as well, that if we bond, that property has to be owned by the state, correct? So if there's if you were going to redevelop it, it would have to be, it wouldn't be owned by the state. Is the request then would have to come from cash, or am I correct on bonding that the bond council would require public ownership for the life of the bonds? Is that, can we get that on the record?
Sure. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, there would need to be public ownership.
Representative Hansen. Go ahead, Ms. Taylor.
I don't know exactly like how long I'd have to consult with Deb Dyson, but
we can work on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and sure. Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we have worked with other landfills, with MMBs. Ownership by the state is possible. A number of landfills that we've used bonding dollars on have been owned by local units of government. What we've worked out specifically on this piece of property, we need an interest specifically on the title to be able to do the work. It could stay under their ownership, but you are correct. There would need to be a restriction for the life of the bonds of over 30-plus years where there cannot be that private development. For a portion of this landfill to be developed right away after its cleanup, that portion would have to be done by cash. Because, as Director Gauthier has mentioned, we're still doing an investigation where that potential developable property could be located will not be known until we've done our follow-up with our investigation and be known later.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, are the conversations that are occurring, are they talking about housing or where people would be? Or is this like a solar farm? There's a number of uses here of redevelopment, but I think that's a big question.
Is that a question?
Have there been conversations, and what are they?
Okay. Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, our focus at the MPCA has been what we need to do for the cleanup and then where there might be potential for developable land. The city and the county would be the ones that would dictate the plans and how it's developed. We have not got into that detail with those communities. I know the city of Burnsville has a long-range plan for that area around Kramer's Quarry, but beyond that, we have not discussed with them what they would do there. Obviously, anything, any type of development done there would have to be able to pass our requirements for cleanup sites to make sure they're compatible with the level of cleanup done. So if we're doing cleanup, if they want to do housing, the cleanup would have to be acceptable to allow for residential folks there versus a solar development.
And we really can't do anything until we get some of these other problems solved. So they might be preliminary questions, but I respect your concern. So,
and Mr. Chair, it's the question would also be driven on the source of the funds.
I get that.
On the end use would drive the source of the funds if we have that question in front of us
right
at this point.
Yep, thank you. Good point. Proceed. Okay.
Mr. Chair, committee members, that was a quick brief update. I know you have another topic, so
we
didn't want to go much longer, but I could add some more questions if there are any.
Shh, be quiet. Okay. All right, moving right along. Okay. Members in your packet, we've got the draft of the Volkswagen settlement. We'll move on to that. And Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Chair,
welcome.
Thank you very much. My name is David Thornton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Today, I am here to talk to you about the draft beneficiary mitigation plan that we have prepared for the use of the Volkswagen settlement money that is available to the state of Minnesota. I'm going to give you a quick overview of the project, the public input we've received, what the plan entails, and what our next steps are. We have planned public meetings in these following locations around the state to get input on the mitigation plan. We have a 30-day comment period available for people to provide information. We developed the plan by getting input from a number of sources. There are some specific requirements that the settlement outlines that we have to follow. A trustee was established to oversee the money nationally, and the trustee has developed some procedural requirements that we have to be mindful of. We had extensive public input from around the state, and we conducted about 13 meetings to get that. We have some specific stakeholders that have been giving us input. These are people who are quite likely to be folks that apply for some of this money. There were hearings last session. We've talked to the tribes, and then we've been using our agency expertise. This is a map shows you the locations of the meetings that we held prior to now to get public input in order to help us develop the plan. These are the things we've heard, the key themes that we've heard at these meetings. People want us to make sure that we get significant emission reductions. They want to make sure that Greater Minnesota is included in this. Our work should be cost effective. We need to consider the different kinds of vehicles and equipments and fuel types. They want us to reduce exposures and help improve public health through this, in particular to help protect vulnerable populations, maximize reductions for people who are disproportionately affected by air pollution, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, support electric vehicles, the long-term future of the transportation systems, and have measurable results. Quite a list of things. this input did influence how we plan to develop the plan, and I'll just go into to that now. The goals that we have tried to encompass in this draft plan are to make sure that we significantly reduce emissions. We want to make sure that there are statewide benefits. We are proposing that 60% of the money be targeted for the seven-county metro area and 40% for greater Minnesota. That mirrors where these offending Volkswagen diesel vehicles were registered, 60-40. We're going to try to reduce exposure to air pollution and maximize health benefits and balance the cost effectiveness of the projects that we fund with other goals. We're proposing to break this down into a three-phase project. The first phase, encompassing about 25% of the funds. The total funding available to Minnesota is $47 million, so this first phase would be around $11.75 million, and that would be over the next 2 years. Phase two, 50% of the money over the following 3 years, and phase three, the final 25% of the money beginning in 2024. There are two reasons why we are proposing to do this in a three-phase fashion and why we've structured the phases as we have, 25, 50, 25. First of all, we're certain that as soon as we begin the projects, we're going to find some things that we wish we had done a little bit differently. So we want to be able to take advantage of learning from our experience and making later phases of the program more efficient and better and more effective. Also, we are also pretty certain that there will be some new technologies coming online in the next few years that we'd like to take advantage of, that would be very cost effective, and we want to save some money in order to advantage those. An example would be on-road heavy-duty electric trucks. They're just barely available right now. They may be more commercially available in a few years and, in fact, cost-effective. And that's just one of an example of that. We're proposing to break the money up into the following different categories as allowed by the settlement. We are proposing that 20% of the money be targeted towards school buses. That would be replacing a diesel bus with a diesel bus, a propane bus, a natural gas bus, or an electric bus. We're proposing to let the school district decide what fuel makes sense for them. Another 35% of the money would be targeted towards what is called clean heavy-duty on-road vehicles, and that would be all of the big heavy-duty trucks that are operating on the road, as well as transit buses would be available for that category. Converting diesel to clean diesel, or again, giving the owner of the fleet or the individual unit the choice of picking the fuel that they'd like to use. And 15% of the money for heavy-duty off-road equipment, this would be things like switcher locomotives, tugs, and off-road construction equipment, cranes and graders and things such as that. The owner can choose which fuel they want to go to. For the most part, I think these would be converted from old dirty diesel to clean diesel. We're proposing that 15% of the money be available for heavy-duty electric vehicles, and that would be taking school buses, transit buses, and airport ground support equipment that is currently operated by diesel, taking that off the road and replacing it with an electric counterpart. And there are commercially available versions of all of these pieces of equipment available and in use right now. And then finally, the settlement agreement allows us to spend up to 15% of the funds on electric vehicle charging stations, and we heard a lot about that when we were seeking input, and so we are proposing to do so. These are the emission reductions that we expect to get from phase one. They're substantial. I'll just skip through the next few slides. would you provide a little more detail about the different categories that we've identified? We're continuing to get public input. We hope to submit the plan to the trustee after we receive the input and change it based on that later this spring or early summer. Send out our first request for proposals during the summertime, evaluate and select the projects, and make the first round of grants later this fall if all goes according to schedule.
Thank you. Representative Becker King.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to comment on the, I appreciate the 60%, 40% Greater Minnesota metro area. I just wanted to make sure folks are taking into account, you know, I myself am a suburban member, but Minnesotans like to travel throughout Minnesota. And I think one of the really important pieces to get people to make that change to EVs, to electric vehicles, is going to be having good charging stations available statewide. I know as I'm personally looking at changing to an EV, that's an important factor to take into account. So I would encourage you to kind of keep those in mind as we're looking at that piece of the funding.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, of that infrastructure piece, we're guessing that about 90% of that money would be spent on what is called DC fast chargers that would be directed at travel corridors around the state.
Thank you.
Okay. One of the things we talked about yesterday offline in my office was the idea that the private enterprise is going to be able to apply for some of this stuff, and I expressed my concern about that. I think that these dollars, and from my perspective on the surface, and maybe I could change my mind, but I think that you would be doing the state of Minnesota and local taxpayers a big favor by directing these dollars to school districts, counties, townships, to allow them to upgrade their fleets and so forth. We've had that discussion. That's the way I feel. We'll move on to Representative Poston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I drive through Brainerd on a regular basis, and I see hundreds, maybe thousands of Volkswagens parked there. What are going to happen to all those cars?
I think Representative Heitzman is going to get up. No, I'm kidding.
Mr. Thornton, Chairman, members, it's over 15,000 of them are parked there, and they have to get out and move them around regularly so they don't freeze in place, not because of the snow, but because of the equipment. They were parked there largely because Volkswagen didn't know what to do with them. They struggled with being able to develop a retrofit that would make them meet the emission standards, and now they have that, and I think they're wrestling with how many of those vehicles can they actually retrofit with that and then sell and make some money off of, or at least not lose so much money off of them, and how much of them are they just going to end up scrapping and recycling. So it's up to Volkswagen what they do with them. I think that's something that they're wrestling with nationally.
Thank you. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. You know, I appreciate your proposal here, but, you know, Minnesota's got a B20 mandate, and, you know, some of the conversations that I've had is a concern from the retailers, but also from the producers about the infrastructure that's lacking potentially to fill these trucks on a regular basis for the B20. Has there been any thought or conversations to use this money, because it's diesel-related, to promote the B20 or to maybe work on some of that infrastructure? Because there is a mandate, and that's one of the things we've heard from Flint Hills and the rest, that would be a great place to put that.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, the settlement agreement prohibits use of this money for any kind of fuel infrastructure with the exception of electric charging. So we would be unable to do that.
There you go. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So just strict, like coal electric charge, that?
Mr. Thornton.
Grid to vehicle charging.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate on page 6 you're maximizing health benefits. But then I look on page 7, and the school bus replacement program, you can use all diesel, propane, natural gas, electric. The problem with some of these is they will have fumes, and those fumes will get in the buses because that's what happens. And so just letting a school district decide without talking about vulnerable populations, without talking about what this means for school children, particularly the youngest school children, I think you need to be more aggressive here in talking about moving to the least polluting for the most vulnerable.
Mr. Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, the quick response that I have to that is that we would anticipate that the criteria that we use to evaluate proposals from all of these different categories, including school buses, would provide a higher score for the proposals that reduce the most pollution and the most exposure to vulnerable populations. So it may not go quite as far as what you're suggesting, but it's heading in that direction. We'll certainly consider your input and think through how we might adjust.
Okay. Representative Clark Johnson. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. Mr. Thornton, you did address the main part of my question, which was what Representative Guggenius was asking, but to what extent do you have the rural school districts involved in this process with the school bus replacement?
Mr. Thornton.
Well, Mr. Chairman, representatives, we are hoping to do quite a bit of outreach to solicit responses to our request for proposals. We're hoping that third-party aggregators come forward and work with different parties, especially the smaller parties, like in smaller rural school districts, and put their projects together, and because they don't have staff availability to do that. And we're also hoping to make the process, the administrative process on this, really easy in some cases. For, you know, replacing an old school bus with a new school bus is a pretty simple thing. And, you know, I sort of envision that we just give them a coupon and a check. So we're hoping to make it as friendly as possible.
Good. And some of the districts that I represent, the electric buses won't work because our routes are way too long. Representative Hornstein, you have a follow-up?
No, that's okay, good.
Representative Lewis?
Just the time we should move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you include things like the rolling stock for Arrowhead Transit? We've got regional transit authorities that are owned by the state, operated by the state, and do they get at least as high a priority as the school buses?
Mr. Thornton.
Actually, we talked to Arrowhead Transit directly, and they run on gasoline, so their vehicles are not eligible for this. But we did look, and there are something like 56 transit agencies around the state, mm-hmm. and they would all be equally able to apply for this, and they'll get the same kinds of considerations as everyone else.
So I understand that if they decided to go to a clean diesel, propane, or natural gas, they could replace their gas rolling stock where it was appropriate and get support?
Mr. Chairman, members, the settlement does not allow replacement of any rolling stock unless it's fueled by diesel. So they would not be eligible for any of the money because they've chosen gasoline as their fuel.
No, that's really disappointing and short-sighted.
Representative Hans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Thornton, did you say that the data for the 6040 came from the car registration system?
Mr. Thornton.
Yes, I did say that.
Okay, I was checking that. I'm assuming that's from during the time when the cars were registered prior to July 24th.
Yeah, I believe that would be right.
And then just one quick follow-up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
Representative Hansen.
At the input meeting that was in my district where We heard from folks who are from disadvantaged communities along the river. And I know that the barge traffic, barge conversion, and you don't have to provide that answer here if you don't have the details, but I'd like to know what the barge component is of this, if there's what the plans are for river traffic that is operated by diesel engines and how that could impact areas along the Mississippi and the confluence in Minneapolis, St. Paul, South St. Paul, and through our district.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, barges are the tugs that move barges are very much available for funding. We've already funded some of that in the state, and they are one of the most cost-effective ways to spend the money because they emit more than almost anything except for a diesel locomotive, actually.
Thank you. Members, before we leave, I just want to remind you that Chair Swodzinski's subcommittee will be meeting next Wednesday. Okay? Anything else for the benefit of the group? Thank you. We're adjourned. Thank